Shabbat shalom.
Shabbat shalom.
It's really a pleasure to be here tonight and to see this congregation. And I'm going to talk about the concept of miracle in the Bible. And I must tell you that I don't know much about the subject. And I'm because in the Bible, there is no term for miracle. We are all acquainted with the term Ness, of course. But the term Ness for miracle actually was created much later, in a much later stage, not in biblical literature. When we find the word Ness in the Bible, it means like a flag or something that you can see, or a sign, something that you see from when you stand quite far from a place, but there is no term for miracle. We have other terms, but no term that we have in the Bible, like the term Gedolot, which are great deeds, or the term Niflaot, wonders, or the term Pele, or the term Ot Umofet, meaning sign and portent. But all these terms do not necessarily mean what we mean when we say a miracle, because all these terms mean actually that God is capable of making these things, but these things that He is making are all anyway the ways that He rules our world. And the way He rules our world is not necessarily what we always call a miracle. So what is a miracle? I don't know what it is, a miracle. But, and nobody knows. It's not that I'm so humble. I'm not, believe me. But like everything else, miracle is something very relative. And I want to start actually by reading you a beautiful story actually from the Holocaust period about a miracle. So the story goes like that. The British Prime Minister, Winston Churchill, invited the Hasidic Rabbi of Gur to come to see him and advise him how to bring about Germany's downfall. The rabbi gave the following reply. Listen carefully. So there are two possible ways, one involving natural means and the other supernatural. The natural means, listen carefully, the natural means would be if a million angels with flaming swords were to descend on Germany and destroy it. The supernatural would be if a million Englishmen parachuted down on Germany and destroy it. Since Churchill was rationalistic, he chose this strategy based on natural means, meaning waiting for angels with flaming swords. So that's, you see how relative the concept of miracle is. And actually, it becomes very clear to us that we don't actually have a clear definition of miracle when we try to make a list of miracles. Let's say that I give you an assignment tonight when you get back home, before you go to sleep. You have time, it's Friday night. Take your Bibles, open the book of Genesis, and try to make a list of miracles. So, for instance, is the creation story a story of a miracle? Is the flood story, is the flood a miracle? Is the confusion of languages in the story of the Tower of Babel a miracle? If the appearance of God to Abimelech, king of the Philistines, in Genesis chapter 20, a miracle? Is the fact that Abraham all of a sudden finds a substitute for his son, the ram in the thicket, is that a miracle? Or is the appearance of Rebekah when Abraham's servant is looking for a bride for Isaac, when she appears at the very moment when he finishes his prayer to God, is that a miracle? You see, I leave you with a lot of question marks, and you see how difficult it is for you and for me to make a decision which story is a miracle story and which story is not. Now, of course, we all know that for God it's pretty easy to create this world. Well, pretty easy for him, just opening his mouth and saying, "Let there be light," and there was light. And actually, we find a lot of like miracle stories in the Bible in which, let's say, a prophet, like the prophet Elijah, pronounces something in the name of God, like in 1 Kings chapter 17, which is text number 1 on your handouts. Elijah says to the widow in Zarephath in Lebanon, He says to her, "For thus said the Lord, the God of Israel, the jar of flour shall not give out, and the jug of oil shall not fail, until the day that the Lord sends rain upon the ground." And of course, it happened exactly the way that Elijah promised. So of course, you'll say, it's a miracle story. But you see, the technique here is very similar, of course, to the technique of the creation story. God says something, and it immediately happens. So if the creation story is actually a miracle story, if the creation is indeed, and I believe it is, the greatest miracle of all, then all other miracles are nothing in comparison to the creation story. It's like an additional brush stroke, you know, on the painting. Here and there, God here and there just corrects a little the painting. It's nothing more than that. Indeed, in the Second Temple period, for instance, a great Jew who didn't live in the land of Israel. Some great Jews live in exile, I have to admit it. But so, for instance, Philo of Alexandria writes in his book, The Life of Moses, he writes, "These extraordinary and seemingly incredible events," meaning all these events of crossing the Sea of Reeds and all these events that we are always talking about, all these great miracles, he says, well, all these events are but child's play in comparison to the great things, the miracles of creation, of nature and existence. Meaning the fact that we wake up every morning, that's the greatest miracle. The fact that the sun rises every morning, that's the greatest miracle. The order that we have in our life, very different than the chaos that we had in your life, one house tonight, that's a great miracle. Yeah. So the great miracles that the Bible tells us about, they are actually nothing to write home about, actually. And if we talk about, let's say, the creation story as being the greatest miracle of all, now you can see under number three of your handout, it's a story that you are all familiar with, I'm sure. The destruction of Jericho. Jericho is the first city in the land of Canaan that we Israelites conquer when we get into the country under the leadership of Joshua, son of Nun. And if you read this story, how for 6 days, 6 days the priests carrying seven ram's horns preceding the ark, you know, surrounding the city. And on the seventh day they march around the city seven times with the priest blowing the horns. And then, of course, thereupon the city wall will collapse, and the people shall advance every man straight ahead. And, of course, when we keep reading this story, we move on to text number 4, the same chapter. We see that actually everything has been destroyed. Everything has been exterminated. Nothing was left. No living creature was left alive in Jericho. And actually, what you see here is like a mirror reflection of the creation story. Because in the creation story, for 6 days, actually everything happened. All living creatures were created. And then, of course, on the seventh day, nothing happened. God rested. On the other hand, when we move on to the Joshua story, to the story of the conquest of Jericho, for 6 days, nothing really happened. On the seventh day, everything happened, and everything has been destroyed. And Joshua even takes an oath that that Jericho should never be built again. It should remain desolated the way it was. You see that in the first city that is being conquered in the country, the author of this chapter wants you to think about the creation story. It's a miracle as big as the miracle of creation. It's a mirror reflection of it. It's an opposite of it, but yet it is related to the story of the creation of the world. Now, if we move on to other miracle stories, we can see that whenever we find a miracle story in the Bible, if we can ever agree about a certain story that it's a miracle story, then again, we know all the components. There is nothing strange to us in these miracle stories. All the components are well known to us. Well, perhaps sometimes a miracle looks like a surrealistic painting, meaning the order changes, meaning people who should be here down on earth, like Elijah, makes it up to heaven. Or the sea splits, the sea of reeds splits. So the order changes, but yet all the components, all the ingredients are well familiar to us. Except for one miracle, actually, and that's under number five, that's the story of the manna, the great food that we had to eat 40 years in the wilderness. I'm sure it was quite boring. But anyway, and you see that in this story, the Israelites question, what is it? And that's why it's called man, because they asked manhu, what is it? What the hell is it? Oh, sure, I shouldn't have said it here in the temple. Oh, I'm sorry, I forgot where I was. Anyway, yeah, but at least I keep you awake. It's fine. Anyway, so, and then the answer is, that is the bread which the Lord has given to you to eat, etc., etc. And again, in the Torah, they try to explain what is this manna all about. Yeah, the house of Israel named it manna. It was like coriander seed, white, and it tasted like wafers in honey. I'm not sure that it's like wafers with honey. Next time you go to a restaurant, you ask for it. Anyway, but, so that's the one miracle, that's the one and only miracle that we are not acquainted, we are not familiar with this phenomenon. But yet, if you read a different biblical text, and that's Psalm 78, in the book of Psalms, you have some historical psalms, which is great. You know, you find the whole history abbreviated, a concise edition of our history. In 72 verses, you get the whole history of the people, very easy to learn. And then in Psalm 78, one of these historical psalms, we hear about the manna that he, the big he, commanded the skies above. He opened the doors of heaven and rained manna upon them for food, giving them heavenly grain. And I should have copied one more verse. I can always blame the secretary. Each man ate the bread of divine beings. Lechem abirim achal ish. The Torah doesn't want to tell us that some creatures who live upstairs, they eat and drink. It's like the mythologies of the Greeks and of the Romans about the nectar and the ambrosia that they drink and eat up there. But here, the book of Psalms tells us what the Torah was trying to hide from us. Yes, they are familiar with the manna. They do know what it is. That's the kind of bread that angels or divine creatures used to eat. And in a case of crisis, of emergency, they let us human eat it for 40 years. So, okay, so we don't know yet what a miracle is. I'm talking and talking, but yet we don't know what a miracle is. But of course, we tend to, if I ask you for a definition of a miracle, I'm sure that most of you will immediately say, well, when the laws of nature are broken for a moment, that's a miracle. When something that we cannot explain, that our physicists and chemists cannot explain, that's a miracle. By the way, I don't like the word nature, because the word nature is not a biblical word. There is no concept of nature in the Bible. In the Bible, there is the concept of creation. So let's talk about, if we do want to define a miracle the way you define it, not the way I define it, but the way you define it, let's define it for a moment, at least momentarily, as when the laws of creation are broken. Well, that's a miracle. But what about, what about a different type of miracles? Let's say, for instance, fortuitous encounters. I hope I pronounced this word correctly. I always have a problem with this word, fortuitous, great. Yeah, I made it. So anyway, for instance, in Genesis chapter 1, in the story of Hagar, the Egyptian, the maidservant of Sarah, you know, she's out there in the wilderness with her poor son Ishmael, and the poor guy is about to die, there is nothing to drink. And God opened her eyes and she saw a well of water. She went and filled the skin with water and let the boy drink, and his life was saved. Is it a miracle? Is it actually different from hitting the rock and bringing water out of the rock? The result is the same. The thirsty ones, the ones who were in danger of death because of thirst, have now water to drink. So what's the difference between a fortuitous encounter and actually the breaking of the laws of nature? Now, another fortuitous encounter, number 8, again the story about Abraham who sends his messenger to bring a wife for Isaac. You know, Isaac is the real Zionist. Isaac is the only patriarch who has never left the land of Israel. That's what we call Asir Zion, a prisoner of Zion. Yeah, he never left the country. So even when he needed a wife, he did it by a messenger. So anyway, as I said earlier, when the servant of Abraham is there praying, immediately at that very moment, Rebekah, who was born to Betuel, the son of Milcah, the wife of Abraham's brother Nahor, came out with her jar on her shoulder, and the love story starts. So our fortuitous encounters should be considered, or should fortuitous encounters be considered miracles? Let's take one story, and that's number 9 on your handout. Look at the handouts, don't look at me. Number 9. The story of Jonah. You all know the story of Jonah, the anti-prophet, the prophet who doesn't obey God, who tries to escape God, and God is teaching him a great lesson. God sometimes is a great teacher. Jonah is a bad student. Anyway, so in the story of Jonah, in order to teach Jonah a lesson, you read from chapter 2 there, that the Lord provided a huge fish to swallow Jonah. And Jonah remained in the fish's belly 3 days and 3 nights. Is it a miracle? You'll say, of course. We haven't heard of, you know, big fishes that people can have a life in their bellies. So if he's there, by the way, the verse that I really like in chapter 2 is when the fish is actually throwing up Jonah out. Because God is really upset with Jonah and he really wants to teach him a lesson. Just think about it. When he comes out of the fish, when the fish vomits him, throws him up, you know how he smells. Sometimes you have to see. Sometimes you got to smell the words, not just to listen to the words. So of course, I'm sorry, you are still digesting your Shabbat meal. Anyway. So, of course, when we talk about this big fish, so that's a miracle because it's nothing that we know. It really breaks the laws of nature or the laws of creation. But then we read that the Lord provided a ricinus plant. What is a ricinus plant? Kikayon, which grew up over Jonah to provide shade for his head and save him from discomfort. Later on in the text, we learn that towards the end of this quotation, that actually this resinous plant appeared overnight and perished overnight. Perished overnight is fine, but appearing overnight, meaning growing from nothing overnight, it's a miracle. Doesn't happen in my garden. So, but then we keep reading and see that God later on providing a worm which attacked the plant so that it's withered. That's just a fortuitous encounter. That here it doesn't break any law of creation. And then again, God is sending or providing a sultry east wind, a chamsin, and that again doesn't break any law of creation. It's just a fortuitous encounter. You see that the writer of the book of Jonah is actually using the same terminology about God providing. Four times we have the same terminology. Two times is actually for breaking laws of creation. And two times the same terminology is used for talking about fortuitous encounters. So at least for the writers, there isn't any difference between the two. If the one is a miracle, so is the other. Now, I would like to look with you at a couple of miracles or at a couple of events and to ask ourselves, does the Bible mean that these are miracles? For instance, let's say whenever God interferes in our history, is all interferences of God in our history should be considered miracles or not? For instance, when God helps us with our wars, and we Jews like to fight, as you very well know, at Judges chapter 4, verse 15, from the book of Judges, that's the story of Barak. I'm not referring to Ehud Barak, then it's an older Barak. Yeah, from the book of Judges. And the Lord threw Sisera and all his chariots and army into a panic before the onslaught of Barak. Sisera leaped from his chariot and fled on foot. Is it a miracle or not? God is helping us. God is throwing these people into a panic. Is it a miracle or not? You don't answer me. So what should I do? I don't know. I'm not very impressed. I'm not very impressed. So he did throw them into a panic. Again, if I would have given you an assignment to write down all the miracles that you have found in the book of Judges, I'm sure that most of you wouldn't have bothered to write this one down. But then when we move on to chapter 5, when the same event is being reported about in the Song of Deborah, chapter 5, now we are impressed much more. The stars fought from heaven. From their courses they fought against Sisera. The torrent Kishon swept them away. The raging torrent, the torrent Kishon, etc. Now the stars are fighting for us. Are we impressed now? Do we think now that that's a miracle? Maybe. So what's the difference? It's the same event reported twice. Once in chapter 4 and once in chapter 5. You read chapter 4 and you say, You read chapter 5 and you say, maybe. So what is a miracle? I keep asking the same question again and again. Now, let's move on. We move, again, God is, you know, interfering with history when he lets his spirit gripping the judges. In the book of Judges, you know, God can choose anybody to be a judge of Israel. You know, a person walks in the street, an ordinary person like me, and all of a sudden the Spirit of God grips the person, and the person has to lead Israel through a battle against its enemies. That's how it happens in the book of Judges. So, for instance, in the story of Samson, Judges chapter 15, we read that when he reached Lehi, poor Samson, the Philistines came shouting to meet him. Thereupon the Spirit of the Lord gripped him, and the ropes on his arms, because he was arrested first, became like flax that catches fire. The bonds melted off his hands. He came upon a fresh jawbone of an ass, and he picked it up. Whenever I hear somebody coughing, I cough. I'm attracted to coughing. I can't resist it. Thank you very much. Anyway, yeah. So, and with it, meaning with the jawbone, he killed 1,000 men. Of course, killing 1,000 men with a jawbone, we are impressed. It's a miracle. But then, another story about the Spirit of the Lord, gripping another judge. Under number 13, it's about Othniel, another judge. The Spirit of the Lord descended upon him, and he became Israel chieftain. He went out to war, and the Lord delivered King Cushan-Rishathaim of Aram into his hands. He prevailed over Cushan-Rishathaim. Is it a miracle or isn't it a miracle? Is there a difference between the spirit of the Lord gripping Samson and the spirit of the Lord gripping Othniel? Slowly, slowly, perhaps you realize where I am actually going to. I am trying to show you that sometimes the difference is the kind of journalism we get. Meaning, when the author bothers, you know, giving us a full report with a lot of colored pictures of the event, then we'll say it's a miracle. But the same event can be reported in two different ways. I can make a great story, you know, a cover story, putting it in the New York Times magazine section, the front page, and make a big story with colored pictures. And another paper, let's say the LA Times, can decide to report the same event in page number 7 at the bottom without actually any, without expanding, without any pictures. And then, of course, you won't relate to it as a miracle. And indeed, I'll skip some of the examples. But what, for instance, about death in a plague? Again, a plague that is caused by God. So perhaps, for instance, under number 15, the Israelites sinned against God. They worshipped idols in Baal Peor. God gets very angry with them. And those who died of the plague numbered 24,000. Great number. So does this number impress you? Would you say that when 24,000 people die of the plague, is it a miracle or not? Well, in some ways we are impressed with the number. On the other hand, nothing is being told. We don't get enough details to impress us with this story. On the other hand, when we read about another plague in under number 16, Exodus 32, then the Lord sent a plague upon his people for what they did with the calf that Aaron made. And there, of course, I didn't bring the whole story. But of course, when you read the golden calf story and how God punishes the people of Israel after they worship the calf, well, you may get impressed that here we do deal with a miracle. So you see, it's all very relative. It all depends on the number of words that actually the author dedicates to this specific event. Now, for instance, I'll give you 2-3 more examples. For instance, number 19. Number 19, let me remind you of the story. That's the story about Abraham and Sarah going down to Egypt. You remember Abraham just got to the Holy Land, to the Promised Land, and then 2 minutes later, there is famine in the land, and Abraham makes a decision to leave the country, to go down to Egypt, because there is always food in Egypt. And of course, he knows that it's going to be a serious problem. He knows the Egyptians, he knows their nature, he knows that they are going to be attracted to his wife Sarah. So he tells Sarah to tell that she was his sister, not his wife. It's a very complicated story, a very problematic story, because Abraham doesn't come out very nicely from this story. But anyway, so at the end, God has to interfere in order to save Abraham and Sarah from Egypt. And we read in verse number 17, "But the Lord afflicted Pharaoh and his household with mighty plagues on account of Sarai, the wife of Abram." By the way, if you read this story, Genesis chapter 12, verses 10 to 20, you'll see that every single word, every single term in this story will later be used in the story of our enslavement and the story of our exodus from Egypt. Every single word, as if it's like the table content for what's going to happen later on in Egypt. And also, this verse that I've just read to you, verse number 17, "But the Lord afflicted Pharaoh and his household with mighty plagues," that's the same terminology that will be used to later in the story of the 10 plagues in Egypt. Here it's in Hebrew, Od Nega, in Exodus chapter 11, Od Nega Echad Avi Al Paro, Od Nega, that's the term for plague. And here in the story of Nega in Gedolim, the same terminology. But of course, when you read the story of the 10 plagues in Egypt, you are impressed. Wow! Well, it's a great miracle. Look how God is actually afflicting our enemies. Because a lot of attention, the spotlight is actually put on the story of the plagues. While here in Genesis chapter 12, verse 17, just one verse, we read it quickly, we move on to the next verse, we don't pay attention to it, and I'm afraid that you would not have included this verse in your list of miracles. Or another example, which will be the last one, because the greatest miracle is that you are still awake. And in 1 Kings chapter 20, we have a story about the Israelites fighting with the Arameans. That's the Syrians, Israel and Syria. You know, there is no great friendship between us and our northern neighbors. There was never great friendship. And we hear that for 7 days they were encamped opposite each other. On the seventh day, the battle was joined and the Israelites struck down hundred thousand Aramean foot soldiers in one day. The survivors fled to Afek inside the town, and the wall fell on 27,000 survivors. Well, again, when you read, read it in a very dramatic way, and I emphasize the number, 27,000 survivors. But again, when you read the Bible, just one verse tells us about it. We read it quickly, we move on, we don't pay much attention to it. But if you think about it, it's not much different from the story we had about the conquest of Jericho, when the wall of Jericho came tumbling down and all the people of Jericho and buried them under the wall. Again, the difference is only the different type of journalism you get. So if, getting to the end of my very short talk, I have to come up with a definition. What is a miracle in the Bible? I would say that a miracle is divine intervention in the rules of creation, either by a break of this order or by means of fortuitous occurrence, provided that it leaves a strong impression on the literary text or in the literary text, meaning that's what counts. Meaning the definition of a miracle is not a theological one, but it's a literary one. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much.